Hello, everyone, and welcome again to Back to the Future, the podcast where we speak to the innovators of today who are making tomorrow happen. And making tomorrow happen with me this week is Jacinth Bassett. Jacinth is an anti-ageism campaigner and founder of the award-winning global campaign, consultancy and community, Ageism is Never in Style. Studying at Cambridge, she tells me, she in fact abandoned a career in law to tackle this issue after seeing how women from her mother's generation were treated in fashion stores and in the wider business and cultural community. Now, in her early 30s, she's also the founder of The Bias Cut, one of the first age-inclusive online fashion boutiques, where I'm happy to see she's managed to avoid the usual cliches such as silver vixens, grey ladies, and of course those other S words we've all come to question and challenge, especially if, like me, you are in fact grey. Silver surfers, silver seniors, even silver sages. Although I suppose I don't mind being called a silver sage. So without further ado, I'm joined this week by Jacinth. Joining me this week is
Jacinth Bassett. I don't know whether I was meant to introduce myself there or not.
That's perfect. I always go, let the person introduce themselves first. And also tell people that you are the founder and CEO of the award-winning global campaign consultancy and community, Aging is Never in Style. Ageism, rather, is never in style. Well, actually, I always think age is always
aging
in style.
Aging is in style. Ageism is not, exactly.
But you're also the founder of The Bias Cut, okay, which is the first age-inclusive online fashion boutique. Is that true? Are you the only one or are there more now?
We call ourselves the first truly age-inclusive in the sense that we, you know, yes, there are others who obviously are more now, but when we started back in 2015, 2016, we like to say age inclusivity is embedded in our DNA. And I think that that is quite rare for most.
Well, what impressed me when I was looking at it is the fact that you didn't use the term silver vixens, grey ladies, things like, I guess, senior silver, silver surfers, silver sages, all of those terms, which yes, people think they're being complimentary when they use them. You know, maybe it is a term that people accept, and maybe I'm just being new fashioned by challenging it and saying no to the silver surfer title. What are we thinking?
I have to say, I mean, I'm so glad you mentioned it because language, which I'm sure we're going to get into in more detail, is so critical for authentically understanding, frankly, all ages, and particularly in a space where we're having what some might consider almost a renaissance of the aging space. Finally, narratives are changing and shifting. In the last year or two in particular, we've seen quite a monumental shift in terms of attitudes. And absolutely, language is such a key part of it. Visuals, absolutely, representation, but so much of it is undermined by poor language. In this space, it is those terms like silver vixen, silver foxes, grey ladies, that actually they are quite patronising.
Yeah, I mean, I guess people feel they're doing you a favour when they use it. So they're kind of recognising your status.
There's obviously, as with all negative narratives, we have to counteract them with positive ones. And sometimes it can go from one extreme to another. But let's also remember, you know, we both say that we've got a few silver hairs, but also there are a lot of people who don't want to have grey hair. And I dye my hair as well. So it's very, it can be patronising. For some, it's actually offensive. And it's just treating people in a kind of monolithic approach of sort of saying everybody's older. The other one is grandma or grandpa, where we see a lot of that term being used to describe somebody older, completely irrespective of their familial status. So somebody can be described often as grandpa core, whatever. And people go, I don't even have children, let alone grandchildren. It's just because of my age, I've now been denoted as this. And it's actually quite reductive. So there's so much to unpick in the language space.
Can I ask you your age? Is that
yes,
permitted?
Absolutely. I'm 32 and I'm all for being cool with saying your age and just embracing it.
Because that's the reason I was thinking, you know, at 63, I have the same issue where I don't want to be, you know, 60 is a new 50. I want 60 to be the new 60.
Exactly.
I want to recognize it. But I was interested to see that you have set up it's not just like an organization or a foundation or a boutique, but it's almost you've created a new philosophy for how people look at ageism, but you're thinking at it from another end of the spectrum. Like at 32, what made you start thinking about ageism? Is it to do with how you're feeling about your age, or is it because what you noticed within, you know, the world you live and work in that you felt it needed to be challenged and called out?
It began with my mum, really. She had me at the age of 40. So really from my teens, I guess, I started on a subconscious level noticing how as she got into her 50s, going through menopause, was getting older, but still very senior in her career, just noticing on a, as I say, a subconscious level, how she was just being treated differently. She was to me just my mum, but she was increasingly feeling invisible and alienated. Talking of fashion in particular, I noticed how we'd go shopping and people were just, well, shop assistants were just treating her differently. She had the disposable income. As she put it, I still love style. I still want to look good. But why am I being treated as if this isn't for me? So that was really where it began. And that was, as I say, more of a subconscious level. And then I went to university and I started realizing, I actually studied law at Cambridge and realized that it wasn't for me. I found it very interesting, but it wasn't my passion. And I wanted to do something that actually, you know, had an impact, could drive positive change. Not to say being a lawyer can't do that. Absolutely, being a lawyer can do that. But for me, where I felt my skill set lay. So I started thinking one night about my mum and I thought, you know, there's something amiss here. This was back in 2012. So really kind of quite ahead of the curve. There's something really disconnected here. We're in an aging population. And yet people, as they get older in particular, are increasingly being treated as secondary, as invisible, as irrelevant. And I wanted to do something about that. So that was really where it all began. And I thought particularly about fashion. I had a particular interest in the industry, how it was, there was a need to disrupt fashion's ageist perceptions and to really champion a new age-inclusive approach to fashion and style and general attitudes around society. So that's where it really began. But over time, if you asked me now where my interest in ageism are, I would say, yes, absolutely. My mum continues to be a core and original inspiration. But I'm much more also interested in aging as a whole, about how all of us are. We are all aging from as the minute we're born. We, as I say, we've got an aging population. By 2030, the number of over 60s is projected to top 1 billion. I'm actually going to be part of the second group of that. So by 2050, that should be doubling to over 2.1 billion. And I'm really interested to see where my future and where my peers will be in that space, as much as also looking at how people are older now. I personally believe that it's rather than why are you interested in ageism, it should be why aren't you interested, because we are all aging.
Well, because I think you've, again, this is why I said it's more of a philosophical position as well as something that's just pragmatic based on your experience working in, you know, the fashion industry, which is, again, was my background. And it was always a debate as to how if you were older, you were either invisible or you were exceptional. So you were on the catwalk because you looked
kooky, eccentric vibe.
Yes, exactly. And it was, they were the terms used, and it was, you know,
there was I know models who've told me they literally had to go to casting calls and were told to put on big glasses like Iris Apfel. Iris Apfel's fantastic, but she's not every woman, right? So exactly that. There became almost a pastiche of what it meant to be an older, stylish woman.
And that, I think, is one of the images that we now take as positive. And I guess, like you, I would challenge that and say it's kind of tokenism. It's creating, I think, exceptions where I think your conversation and your kind of dialogue around ageism is, as you said, to remind people that everybody experiences it. And one of the things I think that we were trying to identify in a report, and I guess in all of the ongoing thinking we have, is that each generation looks at another generation as being ageist. So I always think if I'm chatting to somebody in their 20s, they talk about people in their 30s not quite understanding them and they're quite old. And I go, oh, wow, they're only 30. people in their 30s doing the same things and people in their 40s. So it seems that we've also created within generations, not just older representing 60 plus, it's now older is 30 or older is 40 or 50. So I guess my question is, that being the case, how do we renegotiate the language of kind of transgenerational ageism to recognize the dangers and damages of it?
I think the first thing is we have to remember is we have more in common than we have different. Obviously, there are differences with generations, right? But we actually, the first thing to remember is we all live in an ageist society. So rather than focusing on the fact that, yes, we might have different experiences and the world is changing at such a pace, that does mean, and you know, as your report highlights, there are differences. Actually, when you look at the report, what's particularly interesting is actually a lot of interests or values are the same. It's just perhaps a slightly different point of focus or way in which we might address it. So for example, one thing I thought was particularly interesting was how, you know, looking at the climate change crisis, Gen X feel it's more of a personal responsibility, whereas millennials feel it's more of a political responsibility. But the reality is, but we still all want to see a difference. So actually, yes, we might be at different life stages and have certain different needs and experiences, but actually together, we're all redefining what it means to get older. So we all have that was the other thing that came up, is we're not going to be like the next generation. So i.e. we're all having a different experience of what it means to get older. And from that, also recognizing that actually our core values aren't that dissimilar. And I think that then what we need to do is just really encourage, and this is what we do, is through ageism as Never Stole, really encourage what this, as I say, an intergenerational and age-inclusive approach. One of the things that we see a lot with ageism is still there's a lot of focus on sort of 50 plus. One of the things that I've personally experienced is I've actually been told I'm too young to talk about ageism. And in the last year, I've had people want to work with us who've said, can you pretend that somebody older is your boss? Big and small organizations who go, we love, they can see what we're doing is refreshing, it's important, it connects with our community, it connects with the audience, but they almost can't in their heads work out that somebody younger can do it.
I mean, it is, this is what really struck me about when I was reading your background and, you know, looking at some of the posts that you had created, was the intergenerational key to it, commonality of theme, because if you think about issues across all generations. So if I mentioned purpose, sustainability, climate, the issues of inequality, of how increasingly the 1% control pretty much 80% of the planet's resources, I find very few people across generations who disagree with that. And in fact, that's where a lot of the conversations are sitting. And I think how I look at it, because I go, let's look at the issues. But you are also looking at the fact that if you're in your 30s, you are hugely aware of ageism. It's not just about growing old, but also the slight inequalities that sit in terms of how you could be seen too young to do certain things, or how you could be challenged, to your point about, you know, can you have a boss that pretend to have a boss that's older? Because, you know, this notion that at 23, 31, whatever, you can't be taking seriously. But I want to ask you a question about this current debate you have about longevity. It's a term every group is using, and it seems to be driven by, you know, the billionaires who want to live forever. And it's you know, the other at the end of the argument, people saying, gosh, you know, while some of us are living well, some of us can't afford to live. So there's a huge challenge in debate about age in terms of, I guess, positioning, opportunity.
Privilege,
exactly. So how, again, do we rectify that? Because I have nothing against longevity, but I also then am aware that what sits behind it will be a huge amount of inequity and inequality, and people feeling that while one group are planning to live forever, the other group perhaps don't even have a chance to live.
And also on the point with that as well, a lot of it is still around preserving youth or chasing youth rather than just living your best possible life at the stage you're at. I think the reality is right now it's become a bit of a buzzword that brands are buying into, because it is, I think it plays an important role in reframing aging. Ultimately, we, as I say, we live in an ageist society. but particularly since the mid, you know, with the rise of the teenager and then anti-aging coming in, it's all about really just preserving youth. And longevity, I think, is the next part of the conversation. I mean, intersectionality is something that really needs to be delved into further when it comes to aging, understanding the nuances and the differences with gender, ethnicity, socioeconomic background, understanding, you know, religion, sexual orientation, gender, all these things. There's so much more nuances that need to be explored. So there is part of that. There's also a long part of it where I think that there are a lot of brands who are slightly, perhaps panicking is the word, when they're realizing the narrative is changing, they're realizing audiences actually don't want that anymore. But they also know there's a massive commercial benefit to trying to sell something that is about preserving youth.
Well, I think, you know, if you think about longevity is about extending age, and it seems to be that, you know, there is a point where we used to see, as you got older, you were retreating from youth, and the job of beauty and fashion was to almost preserve beauty by linking it to youth. Now I think it's slightly uncoupled in that longevity is seen to be, you know, if you reach a medium age group, that we can extend the, you know, the lifeline. And I think I guess the debate we will always have is that, is extending that lifeline positive or negative to people who are at the beginning of that lifeline?
Yeah, I think the danger at the moment is this idea of best aging or successful aging. And we always say aging is a privilege, not a punishment, because it is. You know, a lot of people don't get to get older. But it's also important to realize that aging is a privilege, but not everyone gets to age with privilege. And I think where there is a concern is that we're now pushing the best way to age. It's now all this super age narrative. I have a lot of issues around the super age narrative. I know it's a term that's being used to try and champion this idea of disrupting the ageist stereotypical norms of what it means to get older, but it's still implying that there's one way that's more successful than another. And that ultimately for us, ending ageism is about being free to age however you want without judgment or pressure to do so in a certain way. And so there is still a lot of pushing around this narrative of you've got to now invest in XYZ in order to be a super ager.
You see, I kind of think it's also, to your point, where some groups are visible, and because of visibility, they occupy more media space or more media kind of realtree, as you say, in America. And I kind of found it interesting that in some of the work that you did, in some of the survey work, you said, you know, if you think about 88% of women say over 50s are poorly represented in adverts. We see that, you know, we get that. 66% say they cease to feel representative in the media from age 46. But this is where I felt really to your point about we have to ensure that everybody is there. 55% of women over 18 said the way they are portrayed in the media makes them feel bad about aging. So in some ways, the current cliches, current tropes, current isms that we see are damaging. Invisibility is damaging it. And I think the lack of good cogent debate is damaging it. And perhaps also reminding us that there's still a long way to go before we are comfortable about kind of taking part in these things. Do you think, or rather, when do you think, and where and what circumstances you think we will have really open and easy debates without them either becoming pejorative, worrying, or people being shut down because they express a view that may be different to how other people are seeing ageism? I mean, what's your kind of general sense on that?
I would say, do I think in my lifetime, ageism and aging is going to be resolved? No. What I do think, though, is the momentum and the speed at which this movement and conversation as a whole is growing is quite remarkable. So, as I say, I started in this space over 10 years ago. I couldn't get virtually anyone wanting to talk about aging or ageism, or if they did, it was only through a very negative lens. The media in particular just didn't want to hear it. And that's one of the reasons I actually started Ageism is Never in Style. Originally, it was built as a community platform to just spark discussion and debate, because in order to change the narrative, you need to talk about the existing one. And people weren't doing that. So that was 2015, 2016, right? Now we're in 2024. ageism is so topical. It's in the news every day. Now, there is still a certain lens in which it's being looked through. Coming back to what I said earlier, there are certain people who are being considered more valid to talk about it than others. I, in some instances, have been told that perhaps it's not valid me talking about it because of my age. But hopefully, by the time that I'm almost the age of somebody who now is considered the right age to wages, and by then more people are going to be talking about it of all ages. And just in the last year and a half, in particular, I would say even the conversation about what's right, what's wrong has really shifted. So the US, in my opinion, is slightly ahead of us than in the UK when it comes to the social conversation around aging. Politically, policy-wise, it's different. But when it comes to the social and cultural conversation around aging, there's been a lot more acceptance in America around choice. So choices, we have a manifesto with ageism as Nera Star, and number one of our manifesto is choice. And I would say that US, probably around 2019, was when that conversation started picking up. The idea, no judgment, it's your choice to age however you want, free from external pressure. That could be going grey, that could not be going grey, that could even be having some work done, it may not be. It's your choice, as long as it wasn't because you felt pressured to do so due to systemic, institutionalised ageism or internalised, you know. In the UK, it's been a bit behind that. And actually, what we were seeing was a real, again, pendulum swing where people were starting to go, you have to go grey in order to now be seen as accepting ageing. You've got to age naturally. Otherwise, you're seen as essentially being fearful of getting older, and that's shameful. And there have been people who've told me that they've actually been kicked out of communities, groups on social media for perhaps aging the wrong way, and I use that in air quotes, because they haven't wanted to go grey, or perhaps they used the wrong dye to transition going grey. Only in the past year and a half have we started to see that shift, I would say, in the UK. And actually, we've been ahead again of that curve. Our overarching message, and you know, very kindly called it sort of philosophy earlier, has actually resonated more with people in the US, we have found. And in the UK, we are now finding our following the UK is now building and building, 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 because they're starting to realise actually the same thing.
Yeah, you see, I'm finding this fascinating because as a gay man setting out, so, you know, if you think about the 70s, how gayness was still slightly covert. In the 80s, it was more, you know, politicised. It was about visibility, but it was certain kinds of visibility. It wasn't certain kinds of gay people. And now I find the spectrum of how I can be is hugely different and open. And like the point I'm making about this thing about ageism, I think I can only see those things going parallel together. I feel more comfortable about the spectrum of opportunity as a gay man than I do, to your point, about an aging gay man. In fact, within gayness, aging is either seen as a positive thing because you can be the daddy, or it's seen as a negative thing because you really are getting out of the flow or out of the game.
I think that, as you say, I think that's the thing. Age is still something that a lot of people are scared of. I think there's still a long way to go, and we're going to see lots of waves and shifts, and that progress is never linear. There's always people step to one side, things can take a step back. It's going to be an evolving conversation. But what's the first thing that's important is it is a conversation. And so I think that that is why even just podcasts like these, I go to events now where people are talking about aging in a way they would never have done even 2 years ago. The pandemic actually played a role in that as well, I feel. And also the menopause movement. There's a lot around menopause now that it's becoming quite menowashing and a bit commercialized and one too extreme. But it again has played a role in getting people talking about aging.
It opens, you know, that notion of the Overton window. It has brought into public discourse conversations that were kept in the shadows and on the fringes. And I guess looking at that and knowing that at this point of the podcast, we have to step into our time machine, right? I'm going to ask you to jump in with me. I can't describe the time machine because of copyright issues, but we know it looks vaguely like a car.
I wonder what it might look like.
So we're kind of in there, and I'm going to take you back to the past, first of all, and knowing what you know now, what is it you would like to change about the past to bring us to a better present?
Right. So I would like to go back to the 80s, and I'd like to go back to the boardroom where anti-aging was first coined as a term, because it was actually back in the 80s that it was first used as a marketing, created as a marketing term. It was the idea of youth being fetishized or craved was still existed, but it was back then that beauty ad execs came up with the term anti-aging. And the reason I'd like to go back to that point is because of the toxic culture that we have now seen it has essentially created. It is beyond just a term. It is an overarching narrative. There are certain brands in particular that are commercializing the idea of selling anti-aging to children. You know, you've got eight-year-olds buying retinol, feeling they need to have even get work done. Dove created an amazing campaign, The Face of 10. When did The Face of 10 want to look younger? And so that is why I'd like to go back to that point and have that conversation, because I understand the need to create pithy phrases, but that culture that it's fed has become really toxic. And that's what I'd like to go back and talk and address.
Well, I had no idea, because as you said the phrase, I was thinking, of course, where it must have started somewhere. Because now I've heard, you know, pro-aging, which I guess is the antidote to it. And I guess that leads me to the close to the final question is, you're in the time machine again and you're now moving into the future, because now that you've laid the seeds and you're having these conversations and challenging people with images that really make them think about what aging means at a fundamental level, we're 10 years on. And I'm asking you what I call the legacy question. You know, what is it you would like, if you were looking back on the last 10 years, you know, in 2034, what is it you would like to see to demonstrate clearly that these seeds you have planted have grown?
I think 10 years is probably quite a push, if I'm honest. I think maybe 50 years. I think the next 10 years are going to be critical and so important. And I think there's so much opportunity. I mean, it's very exciting. I wonder whether 50 years is a better measure of seeing, like we've talking about again with sexuality, how things change through the decades. Perhaps we need a bit longer to see how this will change through the decades. What I would say is, I hope within the next 10 years, two things will happen. First of all, it will become normalized. Not aging won't be normalized as a whole, but it become more normalized to want to market to all ages and not do it through a fear of alienating a younger consumer. Because that's one of the things that we find a lot of brands, they might realize because there's the opportunity. And as your report, you know, highlights, that there really is such commercial opportunity with the older generations, but they want to market to them, but then they're terrified of alienating a younger consumer. And that's something that we do. I think actually that's where, again, our intergenerational and multi-generational approach is quite refreshing for a lot of people, because I'm an example of someone who loves seeing, you know, an older person. My peers are the same, and we're showing younger generations that these are amazing people you could be inspired by. You're not going to get put off seeing an older... We've got proof of that now, that you don't get put off. And there's actually more and more studies that are showing that. So I'd love to see that happen, where brands are seizing the opportunity to market to all ages. It could be done in a very overt way, or it could be done in a much more subtle way. It's just... it's almost that we don't need to keep having these conversations to say, why are they not listening? Why are brands not marketing to me? Why are they doing it? It's not going to be perfect. Of course, it's not going to be perfect. But I hope that there's that. I hope there's been the investment. Again, DE&I, of those companies that have DE&I statements, only 8% include age on them. And so again, age needs to be part of the conversation of all levels of inclusivity and diversity. Again, it just needs to be a normal part of the conversation. There'll be a point, hopefully, the whole point with DE&I, hopefully, is one day we don't need DE&I, right? And I don't think in 10 years we will be there. But I hope by that point we will have age part of that conversation. I think also the other thing that I would really like to see is younger people, more and more younger people being part of this movement. One of the things that I find really exciting is how many, what increased number of messages I get from students studying at university, maybe doing a dissertation, and they've gone, maybe I'd like to do some, look at age, or I'd like to look, and that's actually really exciting. And also similarly, you know, I've even seen threads on Reddit where people in their 30s are saying, I'm not feeling good about getting older. And people have said, look at ageism is never in style. It actually is really positive to enjoy. So I hope we can have more people who are younger as part of it. And that I think in 10 years we can achieve. I think there's still an awful long way to go beyond that. And as I say, I don't believe that ageism will be resolved in my lifetime or even necessarily the next lifetime. But I think that there is so much progress. We've got Ageism Awareness Day as well in October. And that has come up in the last couple of years. And every year, more and more people are taking part in that. So that's really exciting. So there's lots of opportunity. I think there's a responsibility on both sides. There's the responsibility of us as audiences and as consumers to engage and actively engage. And then there's the responsibility of those in institutions, in organizations, in policy to recognize, and brands, that they have a responsibility to try and change the narrative and be a part, essentially future-proof, because that's the other reality of it all. As we're saying about the aging populations, it's your chart for brands. This is your opportunity to get ahead of the game right now, not be left behind, because you will be left behind. The future is aging. The future is more positive around aging. And you can either be at the forefront of that movement and lead charge and shape it, or you can be left behind and actually become somewhat irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, that's a kind of what I call the, you know, the laggards, which have sat throughout history, where they just don't want to move forward. And I always go, what is the benefit of not engaging in the dialogue, or what is the benefit of not being proactive, given the kind of serious issues we're talking about? And I kind of feel that one of the things I've got from this conversation is that I, being 63 and a half, need to lean a bit further in and have that dialogue more vocally, because I do see a lot of examples where what I call grey lighting, to use the terrible G term, where it just happens and you almost accept it as part of an everyday discourse or non-discourse or activity, that you expect it to happen and you politely call people out. And I think what you're suggesting is, A, we shouldn't. B, we should remain live and open to the ongoing dialogue, because somebody at 32 will have a different perspective. And that should be part of my embracing the ongoing language of ageism and to move forward with it. I guess the other bit is to see how each change is helping us, but unless we're part of the change, it's not going to happen in the way we would like it. And just to kind of finally, I'm just aware of time. Where can I find? I know that I can go to the Bias Cut to look at some of the clothing and lifestyle offers you do, but where else can I find details about your thinking, your philosophy, events that are coming up over the next few months?
So ageismisneverinstyle.com is our hub. It's got all around our three pillars of consultancy, campaigns and community on there. And we've also got the blog. We've got talking about conversation. We've got badges. Our badges are ordered. They're free and we get them ordered in hundreds. And again, they just spark conversation and people love to wear them. I actually spotted someone in Covent Garden wearing one the other day. And so it was just, you know, so way to get involved in the movement, whether it is as a brand or whether as an individual. Then also Instagram, we're very big on Instagram. It's kind of our main social media platform, particularly because we are a lot about visuals and social media campaigns. LinkedIn, actually, we're very active on LinkedIn as well, whether you follow myself or follow Ageism is Never in Style. And we also do actually have a limited podcast series on Spotify. It's just 7 episodes and it's called Ageism And. And each episode actually delves into ageism and how it intersects with another aspect of society, whether that's the workplace, whether that's the media. So that's another place just to start engaging with the conversation. But beyond that, also just have conversations with any person when appropriate, let's put it that way. Don't just start like just, well, I mean, actually, there are some amazing more activist political campaigns and they're very important. But in going back to what you were saying sort of about challenging, one question that I actually get asked quite a lot is, if someone says something ageist to me, what should I say back? And there's obviously a time and a place. And the reality is a lot of ageism is hidden through humor or microaggressions. But you could just say, interesting, why did you say it like that, when it's appropriate? Another thing I would say is think about birthday cards. How many birthday cards out there have really negative messages or kind of patronizing messages about getting old? I actively will not buy one of those birthday cards for anybody. You know, just little acts like that make a difference, because we learn ageist stereotypes from as young as the age of 4, right? So we've got a lot of work to do to unpick that. So we need to make a conscious effort within ourselves as much as with other people to make a difference. And so all of this, I mean, we talk about this all the time on all our platforms. So have a look on Ageism is Never in Style, but ultimately just engage in the conversation and hopefully spread the message. Because as we say, aging is a privilege, it's not a punishment. And we really need to reframe that.
Good. And again, thank you, because I think this conversation will continue. And I suspect with a lot of our listeners who work in fashion, beauty, hospitality, retail, where, of course, ageism is a massive, I was going to say issue, but actually now I think it could be a good way to renegotiate opportunity.
Exactly. And I will say this, whether some have been more performative than others, the number of brands that have featured older people, for example, on the runway in fashion, they get a huge amount of media coverage now. So actually, there's a social need to do it, but there's also a commercial need.
Gosh, I think I might make that my third act career. Jacinth, many thanks again for chatting with us. We will be continuing this dialogue, and I'll also be posting a blog for anybody who is listening, particularly on the business side of things, who really wants to get their business right, and dare I say it, knowing the numbers we're talking about, make their businesses profitable at a time when everybody is struggling to find customers. Until next time, I'm Martin Raymond, urging you as always to keep looking, keep listening, and keep asking what's new and what's next.